From NPR News, this is News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. Marches and pray-ins were held in New York, Chicago, and Atlanta yesterday to protest the acquittal of three New York detectives charged in the 2006 death of Sean Bell. Hundreds of people were arrested in New York for civil disobedience, including the Reverend Al Sharpton and Sean Bell's fiancée. Joining us today is NPR correspondent Margo Adler. She covered the demonstrations yesterday. Hey, Margo.
Hello, Farai.
So let's play a clip of what you taped yesterday. 40, 41, 42, 43, 44, 45, 46, 47, 48, 49, 50. So what was all that counting about?
Well, that was counting the 50 shots that were fired by the three detectives that killed Sean Bell and wounded two of his friends as they were coming out of that Queens nightclub in 2006. And the demonstrations, you know, came in the light of the verdict by Judge Arthur Cooperman on April 25th, who basically acquitted these officers and said that, well, there might have been incompetence, there might have been carelessness, but it did not rise to the criminal. And so now there is all this effort to basically launch a federal civil rights investigation and to do protests. And this protest, which, you know, the protests had been very muted, I would say, right after the verdict. And I think that was partly because there had been serious lines of communications between the Bell family and Mayor Michael Bloomberg, possibly because two of the officers were Black. But I think what's happened now is a mounting frustration. And this demonstration was very much like an old-fashioned civil rights demonstration. 216 people were arrested, including Sean Bell's two friends, including Nicole Paltry Bell, the fiance, including Al Sharpton. And it was done very nonviolently at six different locations, blocking bridges and tunnels, you know, lawyers there to take down names. It was it reminded me of an old-style civil rights 60s demonstration.
So is there any hint of where the demonstrations will go from here? Will there be more? Will Reverend Sharpton, has he announced any plans to move forward?
I think there will be more demonstrations today. This afternoon, Al Sharpton is meeting with New York Governor Patterson. As you know, in the past, Congressman Conyers was meeting with him, with Al Sharpton. And, you know, this frustration comes right and in at the same time as a new report that basically says in the last year, 425,000 people in New York City were stopped and frisked, 90% of them minority. So I think that there's still an enormous alienation between the police and certain parts of the community.
Well, Margo, thanks for your report.
It's always a pleasure.
Margo Adler is an NPR correspondent based in New York, and she joined us from our NPR studios in New York. Reverend Herbert Daughtry was one of the more than 200 people arrested yesterday. He organized a demonstration outside his Brooklyn church to protest the verdict in the Sean Bell case. We spoke to the Reverend before the protest, and now we'll get an update on how they went. Reverend Herbert Daughtry, thanks for joining us.
Thank you. Thank you for inviting me.
So describe what you were doing and where you were when you got arrested.
Yeah, just to put things in proper perspective, we wasn't muted after the verdict. What we said is that we were going to organize to shut the city down. And it took time to have rallies. We had a number of rallies, organizing meetings, committee meetings in preparation for the action that we implemented yesterday and for future actions. So when we were ready, after a series of meetings, we decided that on six sites, which were key arteries in New York City, and we decided who would get arrested. We had to recruit people who would get arrested.
And where were you? Were you outside of your church in downtown Brooklyn?
No, that was one of the meeting places.
Right.
One of the meeting sites was my church in downtown Brooklyn. We met at the church. We, again, identified those persons who were going to be arrested. Our plan was to march from our church to the Brooklyn Bridge, which approximately maybe 10 blocks away. The Brooklyn Bridge would be shut down on the Manhattan side by Reverend Sharpton. We would march to the bridge and stand there for a minute and then move down what would be, I think, eastward toward the Manhattan Bridge, which also goes into Manhattan from Brooklyn. And that is precisely what we did. We marched down toward the Manhattan Bridge. And in addition to that, we marched to the foot of the BQE, which is another artery coming in from Queens. And we marched from this artery to the Manhattan Bridge.
So you're really talking about major, major areas that are controlling huge volumes of traffic. What was the mood?
Oh, the mood was, there was anger. There was relief, anger at the verdict, at the killing, and then the verdict by the judge. And then there was relief. You know, people felt that they were doing something. I mean, a few things are more frustrating than the feel that an injustice has been committed and there isn't anything you can do. And, of course, that's one of the challenges of leadership, to provide channels for people legitimate indignation. So there was an exhilaration, there was a anger, there was a relief, and there was wide participation. I think we have a movement on our hand, and what I mean by that is that when an issue, an injustice, grip a city, then you get wide participation, the young, the old, all nationalities, all religions, and particularly first-time participants. Then you know that people are on the move, and you look and you wonder what is happening to the minds, the spirits of the people who are involved, because now if you've got a movement, it will spill over into other issues.
Well, Reverend Daughtry, thank you so much for joining us again.
Thank you for inviting me, anytime at all.
Reverend Herbert Daughtry is the National Presiding Minister of the House of Lords Churches. The Bell protests are just the latest example in an ongoing battle over how far police can go to do their job. The RAND Corporation, a nonprofit think tank, took a look at these issues of how the New York Police Department treats pedestrians to see if racial profiling really exists. Joining us today to discuss the study's findings is the man who did the research, Greg Ridgway. He's the director of the Center on Quality Policing at the RAND Corporation. Hey, Greg.
Glad to be with you today.
So the New York Police Department actually asked you to conduct this study. Tell us about why they asked you to, and then, of course, what you found.
Well, the commissioner was concerned about the issue of racially biased policing in New York. So he asked me to look at the data that they've been collecting. I heard the reference to the 425,000 stops so far this year, it sounds like. I got data on about 500,000 stops that occurred in 2006, and I took a look at them to see if there was evidence of racially biased policing in there.
So what specifically, when you say stops, what specifically are we talking about?
These are pedestrian stops. These are officers on the street that see some kind of suspicious behavior. They're suspecting a crime. Someone's trying to steal a car, or a report that someone just stole my purse. And so they stop people and question. And if they suspect the person has a weapon, they will proceed to frisk.
So what did you find? What were you looking for? And what did you find?
Well, the question was whether there's evidence of racially biased policing. And the big question that comes up is, in fact, 90% of the stops involved people that were non-white. About 55% of those stopped in 2006 were black. And I think the big concern is when you compare that to the race distribution of the city, there's only about 25% black. So that immediately kind of generates concerns. Social scientists have kind of decided and figured out that comparing to the census isn't quite a reasonable comparison. The New York Police Department allocates a lot of officers to areas that have high crime, receive lots of calls for service, and in New York City, those are predominantly non-white. When I made a comparison to the public's reporting of who crime suspects were, this is the public reporting to the police. These are the kinds of people that are stealing my purse or assaulting and things like this. We found about 65% of those crime suspect descriptions were black. So in fact, who the police are stopping is not that inconsistent with who the public is reporting are involved in crime.
Now, this week, a reporter filed a suit against the NYPD. The case was filed by the New York chapter of the ACLU. It involves Leonardo Blair. He was stopped by police while going home from work. How does this incident compare to your findings? Or you know, basically, groups like the ACLU argue that there still is racial bias, if not extreme racial bias. How do your findings track with that or contrast to that?
Right. So my analysis doesn't look at individual incidents. I'm looking at patterns. I have lots of stops. I look across all the stops to see if there's general patterns and trends that are indicative of racial profiling. For example, I also looked at individual officers. There are about 3,000 officers that are regularly involved in these sorts of stops. And I went one by one through them. I compared each one to their colleagues who were patrolling the same time, same place, and the same context. And I identified 15 officers that were stopping a lot more black and non-white pedestrians than their colleagues who were in that same neighborhood. Some of these were very extreme. You know, one stopping 86% black, while his colleagues are stopping 55% black. And so this is something that the NYPD can actually take action on.
You actually provided some recommendations. Give me an example of one or two of them.
Well, one of the important things is that these stops go well, that the police are professional, that they're there, and it's clear that they're trying to serve the public. Mistakes will happen. They'll pick the wrong person up, that someone will happen to fit a crime suspect description. But the way the police conduct themselves needs to be extremely professional, very polite. And one of the recommendations I made was that they hand the person a receipt when they make a mistake that says, I've made a mistake, here's my name, here's the name of my supervisor, here's his phone number, give him a call, here's how you file a complaint, this is why I stopped you, you're wearing white T-shirt, black jeans, that's the same description that I just received over the radio. And that can go a long way to improving things.
Give me one more.
Well, the other thing was that they need to find out who these 15 officers are and take some action to resolve those issues.
Well, Greg, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Greg Ridgway is the director of the Center on Quality Policing at the RAND Corporation, and he joined us here at our NPR studios in Culver City. This is News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. You've seen them on TV. They're overworked and underpaid, and their clients aren't always lovable. We're talking about public defenders, the lawyers courts provide when a defendant can't afford to hire one. A disproportionate number of African Americans find themselves caught up in the criminal justice system. Often it's these lawyers who fight to protect their constitutional right to a fair trial. We continue our month-long series on criminal justice with a look at public defenders. For some answers, we go to the source. Rick Jones is Deputy Director of Neighborhood Defender Service of Harlem. He also teaches at Columbia Law School. Thanks for coming on.
You're welcome.
So you help run a nonprofit organization that provides free legal representation. You also defend criminal cases, but you get housing, employment, other civil cases. What really is your approach to dealing with what must be a high volume of different types of cases?
Well, my office is located, our principal office is located on 125th Street, right there in the corner of 125th and Lenox. And we are the way that we operate is holistically. We represent people who live in northern Manhattan, north of 96th Street, east, west, central Harlem, Washington Heights, Inwood, and we represent folks. The main way that people come to us is because they have a criminal case or they suspect that they're about to be arrested. We encourage people to come to us as early in the process as we can, as they can, so that we can intercede on their behalf, take them to the precinct, be with them during the booking process, make sure that their constitutional rights are protected. But we also represent them what we call collateral consequences litigation. So if, for example, Junior gets arrested for suspicion of selling drugs, say, in the lobby of Grandma's apartment and it's public housing and they want to evict Grandma from her housing, we'll represent Grandma in housing court. Or if Mom gets arrested and as a result of just the arrest, they want to move in family court to take the children away, we'll go to family court and try to protect her parental rights. We not only represent people in the criminal cases, but oftentimes the collateral consequences of arrests are as important, losing your home, losing your family. And so we'll go wherever the client needs us to go. And we also try to be a part of the community that we serve. So we have after-school programs. We teach in the schools. We go out to community groups. We really want to be a good citizen and a good neighbor in the Harlem community.
Rick, I was reading that some public defenders get paid as little as $40,000 for their first job. Now, law school loans have got to be a lot more than $40,000 for many people. I don't know what your organization pays. I'm not going to ask you. But when you have a situation where many people are being paid extremely poorly to represent clients and to represent a lot of them, is it a danger that they won't be able to do a good job?
Well, you know, I have to tell you, when I started as a public defender almost 20 years ago, I guess, I probably made $18,000-$20,000 a year. But folks don't go into being public defenders, I don't think, principally to get rich. And I think that the majority of people who become public defenders really didn't go to law school because they were pursuing profit. They want to serve. They want to help. They want to be part of change. They want to be part of making their communities and their societies and their world better. And they understand that we live in a society that isn't always fair and isn't always just and doesn't always dispense justice evenly and fairly. And so they want to be part of the solution.
Well, Rick, let me just bring in, we have another guest with us, Brian Waite. He is a senior public defender in the Orange County Public Defender's Office. So, Brian, you, I understand, are actually in court right now. What are you doing today?
Good morning. Yes, I am in court today. I'm actually in trial on a serious multiple count life case right now.
Tell me, you don't have to tell me the specifics of the case, but how much time is, for example, the case that you're working on now taking you? How much time in the office, how much time in the court, and what kind of caseload are you working right now?
Well, this particular case I've been working on for over a year. It was assigned previously to a different public defender until that public defender left, and then I was assigned the case, and I've been working with the case for about a year in preparing it to go to trial today. This particular case is going to be about a 2.5 week case, actually trial time. Our caseload, and I can only speak for Orange County because, as I understand, different counties have different management styles in terms of how they assign cases to their deputy public defenders. But in Orange County, the public defenders are given a caseload that's presumed to be consistent with their talents and their experience in the courtroom and so forth. And we do, as individuals in Orange County, have the ability to tell our immediate supervisors and so forth that we don't want any more cases, or we have enough cases, or we don't want a particular type of case because of our ability, our perceived ability to handle a particular case.
So, Brian, I'm going to ask you this and then ask Rick. How are your clients? And what I mean is, when you tell your client, okay, this is the best course of action, in general, do people listen to you? Do they fight you? I mean, there have been cases in televised trials where people say, I don't want a defender. I'm going to represent myself in court. Are you generally dealing with people who are willing to take your advice, or not always?
Well, I think one of the things that is true with it, as a public defender working with a client, which is true in almost anything, is that you have to develop a relationship with the client, and that relationship is going to take time, and you need to, as a public defender, invest the time necessary to gain the trust of your client. Let them, your client, that is, understand that you are completely familiar with the facts of their case, and you're there to do the very best you can to help them in the situation that they find themselves. And when you take that time, and sometimes that time is going to be months, sometimes it may even take years to develop that relationship. But at the end of the day, the only thing that you can hope for is that the client will have developed a confidence and faith in you that that they'll be willing to trust your advice and direction. Ultimately, the final decision in terms of what's whether to take an offer or go to trial and so forth belongs to the client. But trust is extremely important.
Let me get Rick in and also throw the same question at you about, do your clients follow your advice, but also in terms of the racial issues with particularly African Americans and often a lack of trust in the criminal justice system. How does that affect your work?
I think Brian is largely right. It's I mean, you really have to work very hard at building trust issues and developing trust with your client. You know, we, in my office, a substantial portion of our work is retained. That means clients walk in off the street and ask for our representation, or they call us on the phone, say, my son just got arrested. He's at the 32nd precinct. Could you go down there? And we do. And like I said, we intercede on their behalf. And so that goes a long way in fostering the trust issue right off the bat. A lot of more traditional public defenders, they're assigned by the court. The first time they meet their client, he's, you know, potentially been locked up for a number of hours or days and is in a bad mood. And so they have to do a lot of work up front to build that trust. The other thing that I think that is important is, you know, like the guy before was saying about the RAND study, you know, you have to treat people with respect. People want to be treated with respect. And you have to have good listening skills. And you also have to say what you mean and mean what you say and then do it. If you tell your client, I'm going to be back on Tuesday, be back on Tuesday. If you tell them I'm going to file this motion, file that motion. If you tell them I'm going to talk to your mom and tell her what's going on, make sure you talk to the mom and tell them what's going on. You have to work on building the relationship and building the confidence and building the trust so that when you get to those tough points in a case where you have to make difficult decisions and you're called upon to counsel your client, they believe in you, they trust in you, they have faith in you, and they're more likely to be willing to work with you and to listen to you if you've done the hard work of establishing and building that relationship. Let me just say one other thing about the money thing. I don't want you to get the misperception that public defenders are walking around taking vows of poverty, because they're not. They are. They're overworked and they're underfunded, and they need loan forgiveness programs across the board. They need higher salaries. We need more resources. We need a greater will on the part of the elected officials to fund adequately this very, very important part of our society, which is indigent defense.
All right. Just time for one more thing from you, Brian. When you think about the work that you do, I'm sure that you have to deal with a lot of people who have committed crimes, and I know that it's part of the tenet of the law that everyone needs representation. Do you ever get any pushback from either people in the community or other people who are concerned about the types of clients you represent?
All the time. And the unfortunate thing about our business is that too often I do hear from the community that the standard question, how can you represent those people? The presumption being that anyone who is arrested by the police must be guilty. In fact, I recalled, was it yesterday, I believe, I was talking to an individual and indicated that the type of case that I was currently in trial in, which is an allegation of sexual molestation. And the person said to me, so your client is a child molester? And I said, well, no, there is a difference between being something and being accused of something. But I'm not clear all the time that the community immediately recognizes that distinction.
It must make your job tough sometimes, but please go ahead.
Well, yes, it does, because you're fighting that perception immediately. The moment that the jury comes into the courtroom, the moment they take their seat, they frequently start with the proposition that the client is guilty now. What do we need to do to make sure this person is convicted?
Well, we have to end it there, unfortunately, but I want to thank you both, Rick, Brian. Appreciate it. Rick Jones is Deputy Director of Neighborhood Defender Service of Harlem. He also teaches at Columbia Law School and joined us from NPR's New York Bureau. And Brian Wade is a senior public defender in the Orange County Public Defender's Office. We just heard about criminal defense, specifically public defenders, but what about victims? In some cases, even when people see a crime, they turn a blind eye. Witnesses to crimes involving things like gang activities can often be scared away from giving information to police. And it doesn't help that a stop snitching ethos has been promoted by some hip-hop artists. So does the pressure on witnesses not to speak up hurt neighborhoods? We're going to talk that over with David M. Kennedy, director of the Center for Crime Prevention and Control at the John J. College of Criminal Justice in New York City. Welcome, David.
Hello.
So what's this stop snitching culture about?
Race.
What do you mean by that? That's a very blunt answer.
Yep. Well, we need to be blunt about this, and we need to be honest about what's going on. So the the way you introduced it, I'm gonna abuse you a little bit here. The way you introduced it is the way this usually gets framed, which is it's witness intimidation, it's stuff like hip hop spreading these, you know, insurgent ideas, and both of those things matter. They don't matter as much as people think they do. What is really going on is that after centuries of bad treatment at the hands of the outside world, and law enforcement is part of that outside world, most recently enormously exacerbated by 20 years of drug enforcement and a mass incarceration policy in this country, it has become mainstream thought in many minority, especially African-American communities, that law enforcement is the enemy and good people do not treat with the enemy. So this is not primarily fear, and it's not primarily recent, you know, special cultural influences. Again, those things matter, but this is mostly the price we're paying for American history, and especially for having 2.2 million people in prison, most of them drawn from very troubled neighborhoods. They're mad and they're disengaging.
Well, okay. We talk a lot on this show, and particularly during our special series this month, about the racial disparities. But in Baltimore, for example, a few years ago, there was a woman named Angela Dawson, and she and her entire family, her husband, their
yep.
five children, were burned to death
yep.
by a drug dealer because she was informing on the drug dealers. That's a case that no one can argue. You can talk about history, you can talk about disparities, but in that case, when you have a family burned to death, I mean, what's the resolution for this this whole process of disengagement from law enforcement?
Well, there are a couple of pieces to it. One is that first we need to be honest about what's going on in both directions. So one is we need to recognize the problem for what it really is. And incidents like the Baltimore firebombing properly get enormous attention. What doesn't get that kind of attention is the everyday intrusive penetration of law enforcement into these communities, and even more important, the way in which that law enforcement work is viewed by the community. These are communities in which the drug problem has not been solved, the violence problem has not been solved, in which, in Baltimore, we'll stick with Baltimore, 60% of the younger African-American males in the city are under judicial supervision as we speak. Between 16 and 30, 60% or better are in prison, in jail, on parole, on probation, or on pretrial release. Those are folks who, even if they've calmed down and want to lead good middle-class lives, they can't. They've got records. There's no reason for them to finish school. No reason to take entry-level jobs. The streets are pretty much all that are left to them.
Well, I just want you to tell me quickly, because we don't have much time. Apparently, High Point, North Carolina has found some ways of dealing with this. What are they?
So we tell the truth about this stuff. So law enforcement says to the community, we haven't solved the problem, and without meaning to, we've done a lot of damage, and we'd like to do differently. The community, for its part, has to look inward and recognize that only the community can set strong standards for the way it wants to live, and that unless the community is saying very clearly there's right and there's wrong and gun violence and drug dealing is wrong, that nobody from the outside can carry that weight.
Well, David, unfortunately, we have to end it here, but thank you so much.
Sure.
David M. Kennedy is the director of the Center for Crime Prevention and Control at the John Jay College of Criminal Justice in New York City. I'm Farai Chidea, and this is News and Notes. It is time for sports, and that means Tony Cox is in the house. Hey, Tony.
Hey, Farai.
So I understand today, instead of just talking about sports, you're also talking about sports bloggers?
Well, that's right. And you know why? Because the relationship between old-school sports journalism and new-school sports blogging is like an arranged marriage, and both sides are still feeling each other out, sometimes with not-so-pleasant results. So we're going to examine that with a couple of people who are on the inside of both worlds. We've got Roy Johnson, who is vice president and editor-in-chief of Men's Fitness Magazine and a longtime print journalist with a stint at Sports Illustrated and elsewhere. And we've also got D. Will, who is one of our regulars on the Sports Bloggers Roundtable. He writes for the blog Sports On My Mind. Hey, fellas.
Hey, Tony.
Hey, how are you
doing,
Tony?
It's good to have you both here, and I think that you are both particularly well situated for this discussion. As I said, the issue of whether sports bloggers are elevating and expanding the discussion of sports and media, or are merely contributing to its downfall with uninformed, poorly written, often obscene posts is certainly being talked about, and a lot. In fact, there was quite a nasty exchange recently on the Bob Costas HBO show Costas Now. It featured Pulitzer Prize-winning author Buzz Bissinger and Will Leach of Deadspin.com, no pun intended, which has a reputation for being one of the more notorious websites. Now, here's a snippet from that show. Costas is speaking with Will Leach of Deadspin.
There are a number of sports blogs that are well-written, make good points, are insightful, and are funny. But there's a very large percentage that, where the quality is poor and where the tone is abusive.
Yeah, and frankly, those are not the ones that are most widely read. I think the nice things about the web is it's a meritocracy. Like, sure, anyone can start a blog. But to get a readership, you have to be serious, you have to be consistent.
So, Roy, the main criticism of sports bloggers from what we'll call traditional journalists is that bloggers have little or no credibility, no oversight. They say things, usually mean-spirited things, without facing any consequences for what they post. I leave anything out?
Well, Tony, that seems to be the argument, and I vociferously disagree. First of all, I don't like generalizations. When you first began describing...
Let me interrupt you, ask you to start that again, because we had a little technical problem. I didn't hear the beginning of your answer. So go start it again for us, Roy, if you can.
What was the question?
Well, the question is, did I leave anything out in terms of talking about the criticism that is directed toward sports bloggers?
You didn't leave anything out, Tony, but what's interesting is that a lot of those same criticisms have often been levied at general sports journalists. You've got the good and you've got the bad. And what I don't like in any description is gross generalizations. It's interesting, in your introduction, you talked about old-school journalism versus new-school blogging and it being an uncomfortable marriage. I guess I am married to myself, because beyond my number of years in traditional sports journalism, I am also now blogging for Yahoo Sports. About a year ago, I started my own sports blog called Ballers, Gamers, and Scoundrels. So I'm straddling both worlds. And I think what you have is what Will described totally as a meritocracy. There are a number of bloggers who are uninformed, who perhaps use language that we wouldn't use either in print or on the web, but they have a right to opinion. These are the same people who were in the bars, are yelling at televisions for generations, talking about sports. Now they have a forum to do that, and it just remains to be seen whether anybody is really listening.
Well, D. Will, do we need to use new eyes to judge this new journalistic technology? And also, do you think this is helping or hurting in terms of building a wall between athletes and fans?
Well, I don't think that we need new eyes. What we need is a true meritocracy, actually. The blogosphere is a reflection of our society. Sports blogosphere is largely white. Young white men who are commanding the internet waves. There are people like Roy who do great jobs on their blogs and can truly make a difference. A lot of people who are trying to do journalism on a blog aren't heard, actually. And the more outside of mainstream opinion you are, the less you're heard. And I think, though, that all in all, I don't think that it breaks or builds any walls between athletes and press. I think it actually breaks them down.
Really? Do you agree with that, Roy?
Well, it's interesting. A lot of athletes are blogging themselves. Everybody right. knows about Gilbert Arenas, but there are of the Washington Wizards, but there are plenty of athletes who are tech savvy as their peers of their generation are as well. They walk around with laptops. They are engaged in the internet. So I totally agree. I think it has broken down a bit of that wall that began to emerge 10, 15 years ago when athletes and reporters who covered them were more separate. You know, back in the day when I covered sports, we pretty much traveled on the same buses and then oftentimes on the same planes. That doesn't happen anymore. So there was a greater wall built up that is now being broken down by some of the technological advances that allow people to get online and dialogue with each other.
Well, Will, let me put this question to you. Have you ever tried to get a credential to cover a sports event as a blogger? And what happened if you did, or did you think you even need to do that?
Yes, I did. I have tried to get credentials, and actually no one has ever returned an email or a phone call for credentials. And I was originally in the mainstream when I was much younger and left, and now am returning to writing. And so I do have a history within mainstream journalism, and I still cannot get credentials just with sports on my mind at all.
Sports is still trying to figure that out. Part of it has to do, and I don't think this is a total justification, with space. There are so many more bloggers out there, and also their inability to determine, for lack of a better term, who is a credible blogger. So many have made the blanket determination that they just want credential bloggers, which I think is changing every day. You may or may not be aware of the case in Dallas where Mark Cuban, late during the season, decided to ban local bloggers from the locker room. He said it was just getting too crowded, and in part he may not have agreed with something some of the bloggers were saying. He was spammed quite a bit and ultimately changed his mind. So I think you're going to see more and more of that as we evolve, and probably sooner rather than later.
Would you be in favor, Roy Johnson, of there being some sort of, and I don't know what it could be necessarily, some sort of check and balance for bloggers who are writing about sports in terms of what they are able to get away with?
I think there should be a check and balance for all journalists. I recently did some teaching and was surprised at how the level of writing and understanding of journalism ethics had diminished over the last few years. So I was concerned that young people coming into the industry may not be coming in with the same level of talent, maybe same level of teaching and understanding of the business as some of their predecessors. So, you know, when it comes to standards, I think, yes, they should apply across the board, whether it is to journalists who are working for traditional media or for bloggers as well. Yes, there always has to be some sort of standards. Otherwise, there is total chaos.
How can you bring a standard about, though, D. Will, for bloggers?
Yeah, and that is the problem, is bringing about a standard. That's just what I was thinking about. How do you do it if you're a team or a league and a blogger, quote unquote, is petitioning you for a press pass? Do you have to look at their work first? And then how many bloggers do you have to look at? It's a really thorny issue. I do believe that as more and more bloggers become affiliated with mainstream journalism, offshoots of newspapers, offshoots of magazines or sports media outlets, I think that that will be able to be handled better. But for now, that's really difficult to judge.
One more blogger. Oh, go ahead, Roy.
It's difficult. One of the matrix that were used years ago to determine whether local media here in New York were credentialed was just circulation size. And you know, there are matrix now that measure traffic, for instance.
But unfortunately,
it's not totally accurate, but there
right.
are things you can begin to put in place to determine whether someone can get credentialed.
Unfortunately, popularity is not quite necessarily worth, and journalism ethics and stuff like that, they don't quite correlate, as Deadspin can attest to.
Mm-hmm. All right, let's move on to one other topic in the time that we have left. Two, if we can squeeze them in. First, it's Kobe Bryant. He's finally done it, awarded the Most Valuable Player Award yesterday. But, you know, here in L.A., believe it or not, people are still wondering how much he is liked because of the baggage that he has carried from the Colorado trial, the Shaq breakup, and, of course, his demand to be traded at the beginning of the season. Now, it may all be forgiven, given the Lakers' run into the playoffs so far, but, Roy, it doesn't appear to be forgotten. What do you make of him as an MVP choice?
Well, the easy answer to your question is I would have put Chris Paul first, but I applaud Kobe Bryant for his award, winning that award for the first time. As to whether he still has any baggage, I would say absolutely not. You cannot win this type of award unless, for, you know, right or wrong, you have overcome a lot of those image issues. You know, the people who vote for that award often are clouded by their personal views regarding an individual athlete. So I would say that in some other years where Kobe Bryant may have played as well, he probably wouldn't have gotten this recognition. Also, you want to look at jersey sales. I mean, he remains the leader worldwide among jersey sales. And when you watch the Lakers are now one of, if not the most popular teams to watch on television, and people aren't tuning in to watch Pau Gasol. They're tuning in
to watch Kobe Bryant.
So I would say, you know, relax, L.A. The concerns about whether he's gotten past it should be allayed by not just this award, by other measurements as well.
One other person who had some baggage, who is now claiming that that baggage is keeping him from playing, is Barry Bonds, who says nobody wants him or his bat this season, and he is out of work still. Sports Talk Radio and, of course, the blogosphere are bandying about the possibility of collusion by Major League club owners against him. You buy any of that, D. Will?
Yes, absolutely. Barry Bonds did have a 48% on base percentage last season, and that says it all. There are many teams that need a DH, and that Bonds isn't even talked about is insane to me. The MLBPA, the Major League Baseball Players Association, in fact, is asking to look at the books of off-season movement, in particular with Bonds only right now. They do that every season with players, but this year they want to look at Bonds specifically.
D. Will, I love what you say, but I'm going to respectfully disagree and maybe put us all in position of an owner. You know, while many teams might need a bat, Barry Bonds is more than a bat. Right or wrong, he brings along with him all of that baggage. We talked about Kobe Bryant not having any more. Well, it's all got BB on it now, Barry Bonds. He carries a negativism that I'm not sure if I'm an owner, I want to bring to my stadium. I also don't know how good of a teammate he is. Yes, he has some supporters among some of his past teammates, but there's also detractors. So, you know, having a team is a delicate balance. And in this time when baseball is trying to get past the steroid era, yes, he's never failed a test, but that cloud hovers over him. He has not been the kind of teammate that would be ideal, and you don't know what you're going to get in that circumstance. Plus, his play in the field is not something that you can rely on. So,
well, yeah.
Collusion means they all got together and decided not to do it. I'm not sure if I'm an owner if I would want to take that risk.
All right, guys, we're out of time, unfortunately. There's a lot that we could talk about. We'll have to revisit this topic when I have you both back, and we can talk about what you're going to be blogging about in your respective blogs today. D. Will, Roy Johnson, thank you both very much.
Thank you, Tony.
Thank you, Tony.
Bye-bye, D. Will.
Take it easy, Roy.
Joining us today was Roy S. Johnson, and he's the vice president and editor-in-chief of Men's Fitness Magazine, plus D. Will. He writes for the blog Sports on My Mind and spoke to us from Vermont Public Radio in Colchester, Vermont. And, of course, NPR's Tony Cox was with me here at NPR West. And now, time for our letters. Joining me to dig through the mailbox is editor Sasha Woodruff. Hey, Sasha.
Hey, Fry. How are you?
I am doing great. So what are our listeners talking about this week?
Last week, we did a segment on the high rate of African Americans in the prison system. We talked to Ryan King, a policy analyst with the Sentencing Project, a nonprofit criminal justice police group, and the governor of Iowa, Chet Culver, about the racial disparities in the prison system.
Andy Carruthers didn't think the segment had enough balance and wrote us this. Very disappointing that your program had no person to balance the outlandish claims of the Sentencing Project spokesman, who came perilously close to dismissing the responsibility of criminals for their actions and denying the realities of horrific black-on-black violence. Surely you can find a credentialed voice to communicate the countervailing view. Farai Chidea was awfully gentle with this guest.
We also got a bunch of letters about a segment we did on the Supreme Court's approval of an Indiana law that requires voters in the state to show a government-issued ID before voting. Our guest, Ron Christie, vice president of the lobbying firm DC Navigators, said this.
I think it's one of the most sacred privileges, not a right, but a privilege, to be able to exercise the right to vote in the United States of America.
We, of course, got a slew of letters about that comment. Here's one from Todd Carpenter of Baltimore, Maryland. Apparently, Mr. Christie needs to take Constitution 101, or essentially read the document. Just to quote a few relevant passages, the 18th Amendment reads, "The right of citizens of the United States to vote shall not be denied or abridged by the United States or by any state on account of sex." Todd continues, "I realize that from the perspective of being fair and balanced, you need to have someone like Mr. Christie on your show. But can't you get a token Republican who isn't a complete idiot?"
Matthew O'Brien of Berkeley, California, seconded that letter. "I think you would do well to find somebody who is better qualified and can offer greater insight into legal matters. It seems Mr. Christie is on the program a lot because you have trouble finding another African American who talks the Republican line. I think you can do better."
And then we had some love from Thomas Henderson, who listens to us on satellite radio. Here's what he wrote. "I have found NPR to be refreshing, and I look forward to learning every day. I have enjoyed Farai's objectivity with respect to interviews. She handles herself very well and has very interesting topics."
Thanks, Thomas.
And that's it for News and Notes letters this week, but please keep yours coming.
To write us, just log on to npr.org and click on Contact Us. When you get there, you'll see lots of shows to choose from. Make sure you pick News and Notes when you write to us.
And be sure to tell us where you're writing from and how to pronounce your name.
Thanks, Sasha.
No problem.